Robin Young, it's Here and Now, and we start today with an incredible press conference. Members of the Scarlet Knights basketball team of Rutgers University addressed the maelstrom of controversy that erupted after radio personality Don Imus called the women, including five freshman girls, a group of nappy-headed hoes. At midday East Coast time, the team held a press conference, as we said, and team captain Essence Carson was one who spoke.
Not only has Mr. Imus stolen a moment of pure grace from us, but he has brought us to the harsh reality that behind the faces of the networks that have worked so hard to convey a message of empowerment to young adults, that somehow, some way, the door has been left open to attack your leaders of tomorrow.
Imus has been suspended for 2 weeks by NBC and CBS Radio starting Monday, and he's repeatedly apologized for his remarks, including on the Today Show this morning.
It was comedy. It wasn't a malicious rant. I wasn't angry. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't stating some sort of philosophy.
He did go on to say, though, that it was wrong. He also appeared on the radio show of civil rights activist Al Sharpton yesterday. Sharpton has said Imus should be fired despite his apologies. Well, for more on all this, we turn to Richard Prince. He's a journalist who also writes about diversity issues in an online column called Journalisms for the Maynard Institute. Richard, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, your reaction to what you heard of the Rutgers press conference today.
Well, it was rather moving, wasn't it?
It was. I'm thinking of the coach, C. Vivian Stringer,
yes,
who spoke passionately about how proud she was of the girls, but also her own story. Let's listen to a little of what she had to say.
It's not about the Rutgers women's basketball team. It's about women. Are women hoes? Think about that. Would you have wanted your daughter to have been called that?
Richard Prince, where's your gut when you hear that?
Well, I think that she's definitely making this a personal story, and it brings home the point that when people talk about groups like this, painting them with a broad brush, they may not realize these are real people we're talking about, with real lives, and they hurt.
Yeah.
And as the team members said themselves, he doesn't know us. He doesn't know what we've been through. He doesn't know that this person's a future lawyer. This person is a barrel of laughs. To toss out these casual comments like this, I think it's actually a lesson to all of us when we engage in this kind of thing and when we tolerate this kind of environment.
Well, you mentioned that the girls are, you know, thinking Imus doesn't know them. Apparently, he's going to get to. We're hearing news that they're going to have a private meeting. This isn't the first time Don Imus has gotten into trouble for making racially insensitive remarks. He once promised columnist Clarence Page that he'd no longer use racial humor on his show. What do you think should be happening now?
Well, I think he should go. I think that what's happening now is that Imus and his supporters are making this an issue about how Imus is really a great person and does all these wonderful things. But the other issue is, what is the proper and appropriate use of the airwaves? And I think that dismissing Imus will send a signal to Imus and all the other shock jocks around the country who hear what Imus does and said, oh, I can do this too. And they do it.
Well, Simon & Schuster Publishing House told the New York Times that the Imus Show has been a fantastic forum for authors, and for that reason it would be a shame if the show were canceled. You know, others are saying that, you know, coming to his defense, saying that 99% of the time he afflicts the comfortable and comforts the afflicted, and that he actually could turn this into a forum for dialogue about this kind of language. He's already said he feels there should be a black person on his show.
Yes, he does say that, and there are plenty of other people who have been convicted of crimes who say that. I think as journalists, we all know about the person who was arrested, and you go to the to their neighbors, and they say, "Oh, they always seem like such a great person." You know, I never would have suspected this. You know, a lot of us compartmentalize our lives, and there were a lot of people throughout history who were had done great things, but they were lousy in other departments. And I think that good deeds don't excuse the bad ones.
Well,
this is not about Imus as a single person. This is about what is appropriate for the airwaves.
Richard Prince, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NASA is expected to announce later today when it will reschedule the space shuttle launch that was postponed after hail damaged the shuttle Atlantis in February. The postponement could also mean astronaut Sunita Williams won't be coming home in July as planned. Williams is living these days at the International Space Station. You might have heard she's going to run the Boston Marathon on a treadmill up there next week. That delay could cause her to break the U.S. record for continuous time in space. Well, former International Space Station astronauts Donald Pettit and Kenneth Bowersox could give Sunita Williams some advice on extended stays in space and how dependence on the shuttle can be risky business. In February of 2003, Bowersox and Pettit and Russian astronaut Nikolai Budarin were on the space station when the space shuttle Columbia went down and the shuttle program was put on indefinite hold. The three suddenly lost their ride home. Reporter Chris Jones wrote about the plight of Budarin, Pettit, and Bowersox, first in an article for Esquire magazine and now in the book Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. And he joins us from the studios of the CBC in Ottawa, Canada. Welcome.
Hey, Robin. How's it going?
Fine, especially since I'm not stuck in the International Space Station. First of all, I don't think a lot of people remember that. When they think of the shuttle, they naturally think of the poor astronauts who are on board the shuttle who are incinerated. They don't think of those who were sitting up waiting for a ride home. But in fact, those astronauts knew each other.
Oh, yeah, they were good friends. And in particular, Don Pettit, who's the science officer of this particular mission, collectively known as Expedition 6, was really good friends with Columbia's pilot, a guy named Willie McCool. While Columbia was in space, Don and Willie were playing a game of chess. Don had invented this chessboard that you could use in space, and they would email moves to each other. And in fact, the last conversation between Columbia and the space station, Willie relayed his next move, E2 to E4, and that was sort of the last contact the shuttle had with the guys on the space station.
Right. And then they get the call from ground control. As you say, nine words.
A guy named Jefferson Howell, who's the head of the Johnson Space Center, got on the line and he said, "Guys, I've got some bad news." And because it was Jefferson Howell who was saying, "We've got some bad news," they knew exactly what the next words were going to be, which were, "We've lost the vehicle." And they couldn't see what we saw. They couldn't see the pictures of shuttle breaking up, and they certainly couldn't see those terrible images of an astronaut's helmet lying on the grass in Houston. So there was that sort of disconnect for a while. But then when they finally realized that their friends were gone, you know, they had the grief and the sadness of that realization. But then, you know, shortly thereafter, they suddenly realized, well, I guess the shuttle's not going to be coming to get us anytime soon.
And they were about a month away from coming home. I mean, talk about ground control to Major Tom. You know, the David Bowie song, you know, guess what? You're sort of up there. Ironically, at this point in the story, they had finished their set-up science experiments. They were into the science of accident, fluke science, which, I mean, there's irony there. But they also, at this point, come a couple of questions. First of all, how do we get down? And what happens when you stay up too long? And what were some of the considerations for staying up there? I mean, you know, of course, there are jokes about they're running out of coffee. But, you know, for instance, you write about what happens to your legs when you are without gravity.
You begin to atrophy. We don't pay attention to these things because we've had gravity our whole lives. But you have to remember that astronauts are suddenly without something that we've been born into and have experienced and that our bodies recognize even if we're not recognizing them. So the muscles that you and I used this morning, you know, to get out of bed or to walk outside, they weren't using. And so the muscles begin to atrophy. Your bones begin to decay. You lose calcium. And then there's the psychological effects, of course, of long-duration flight.
Right.
And you have to make sure that these people aren't going to go crackers up there.
Well, and now you have, as you write, Bowersox, the firstborn brother. He's a real leader. Pettit, who'd never before been in space, the wide-eyed kid who eats his coffee with chopsticks. And Budarin, the weird uncle from Russia. What are they doing while they're waiting to hear?
Yeah, it's funny. When they first found out about Columbia, they knew that Columbia would, or that the Columbia accident would leave the shuttle fleet grounded. They knew from our experience with Challenger that it would be a while before the shuttles were flying again. And NASA was pretty upfront with them and said, you know, you might have to be up there for a year. You might have to be up there for 2 years. We just don't know. If you sat up there and were idle and let your mind focus on those things, if you looked out the window and you saw the lights of Houston and, you know, were suddenly lost, you wouldn't make it. You would go crackers. And I think what these guys were very good at was settling themselves in. As soon as they realized they weren't coming home anytime soon, any kind of strings that still attach them to Earth, they pretty effectively cut. Now, that became a problem, I think, when it was finally time to come back. In fact, one of the surprising things for me about the story was when they were told they were coming home on a Russian rocket called the Soyuz, they were disappointed, not because they were scared to ride this Russian piece of hardware, which was pretty rinky-dink, but because they had set their minds to being up there for a year or two.
Setting a record.
Setting records. Or, you know, for them, it's just this, they see what for you or I might feel like being locked in the trunk of a car. I mean, this is a fairly small ship by the standards of, you know, an American house, say. For them, they were in some ways in this perfect little bubble. And once they turned their minds towards staying in it, that this was going to be our home, that we are a new family, and we are in this together, it took a lot of shaking to sort of get them out of that mode.
Well, and you describe, you know, some of the elements of being in space, although there is the, you know, the fact that if the integrity of your spacesuit is compromised, your blood will boil you to death. You have a 1 in 800 chance, I think, of getting hit by some scrap thing that will turn the entire space station into nothing, you know, a vacuum. Mm-hmm. But offsetting that, they went out to fix a hatch once, I think, at some point, and so went on a spacewalk.
Yeah, went on two spacewalks.
My heart is, you know, stepping out into nothing, the way you describe it, I would think that would be a high that, you know, might dangerously keep somebody up there longer than they should.
You're absolutely right. I mean, first off, astronauts are pretty goofy people in a lot of ways, and they can do things that most people can't. And I think a spacewalk, at least that initial moment where you crack open the hatch and it's just black outside, and then you step out. And they talked about sort of being on the spacewalk and things like you always feel like you're falling because of the speed of the space station and the way the Earth is moving below you. You feel like you're falling off this thing. And all that's really attaching you there are these thin tethers. And if you, as you said, if you get cut loose or if you get struck by something, you're in for a pretty horrible demise. But these guys are able to turn off whatever little system is inside of ourselves that says, don't do this. They can turn that off and they can focus instead on things like the beauty or like the experience. And astronauts who have gone on spacewalks talk about it being the highlight of their lives. And the difference, I think, you know, an astronaut's career and normal lives, they can pinpoint exactly when they peaked. You know, the rest of us don't have that burden. We can hope that our peaks are coming up, you know, that we haven't yet reached them. Mm-hmm. An astronaut who's done a spacewalk knows that 6 or 7 hours they were rocketing through space attached to this hunk of metal by a cloth tether or by a thin steel cable. That was their moment.
That's Chris Jones. His book is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space. We're going to have more with Chris in a moment. But later today, a conversation with John Holley. After his son was killed in Iraq, he pushed through the new policy that ensures that all the fallen come home on corporate jets rather than commercial flights, be met by honor guards instead of baggage handlers. That's later today. Back after a quick break with Chris, here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now, back with Chris Jones, who's telling us the story of Expedition 6. That's two astronauts and a cosmonaut who are stranded aboard the International Space Station when the shuttle Columbia went down. And Chris, before the break, we were talking about how the three had adapted to the idea of being on the station, so much so that the one fight that Bauer, Sox, and Pettit had was when they thought one of them would have to go and one stay, and they both wanted to stay. But on the other hand, you write about how they made another discovery when they watched the film Tank Girl. What happened?
I don't know if you've seen Tank Girl, but no. It's not a good movie.
Okay.
But what it is violent and loud and colorful, and there are women in bikinis, and there are oxes getting shot in the head. And for these three guys huddled around this laptop watching this film, it was sensory overload. All of a sudden, they were seeing all these things that they'd been insulated from for several months. And, you know, I think life on Earth, we sort of build up these calluses that we don't really know we have, but in dealing with each other and in watching TV and in being stuck in traffic, we sort of build up these buffers. Well, they get stripped, you know, when you're in space. And for these guys only lasted about 20 minutes in this movie before they ended up terrified. And all three of them were in their sleeping bags that night, shaking like kids who've been told a ghost story around a campfire. And when they got out of bed the next day, that's when they all sort of said to each other, well, maybe we've been up here long enough. Otherwise, you know, the problem won't be how do we get home. The problem will be how do we adjust once we get home.
Yeah. Well, as you write, they are going to come home. Pettit and Bowersox are about to become, in our storyline, the first American astronauts to return home on a foreign vessel. They're also about to become the first American astronauts since 1975 to return home in a capsule, forced to put their faith in the parachute above them rather than in the landing gear below. They might have always dreamed of flying, but here now, Expedition 6 is being asked to fall. In the Soyuz, they plummet out of the sky. And this was another blow to NASA's pride, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, people have sort of said it was an easy decision, that the shuttle wasn't flying. You couldn't leave them up there indefinitely. So the Soyuz, which is always attached to the space station like a lifeboat, was the obvious remedy to this problem. But it wasn't an easy decision because there was a pride there. There is this idea that we don't particularly want to lean on this other country. We don't want to put the lives of our astronauts into the hands of another country. And, you know, even though at the International Space Station, the Russians, the Americans are partners, I think there's still maybe a distrust between those two organizations. And you get something like, you know, it's probably apocryphal, but the great story about the distinction between these two programs is that the Americans spent millions working on a pen that would write in zero gravity, and the Russians pack pencils. I mean, they're a very pragmatic, bare-bones kind of operation. And the Soyuz, which is this technology, is old, lumpy technology. I mean, it's an ugly ship. When we were on the moon, the Russians were flying Soyuz, and it hasn't really been updated much since.
Well,
NASA to suddenly say, we're going to put our guys in this bucket, was a tough choice.
Right. Although the bucket did have, and maybe this is part of the archaic technology, it has a sawed-off shotgun.
You know, it's funny, Rob, I don't know if you heard about this. It was a small story about this astronaut who went a little loopy and drove to Florida in a diaper.
Yes, we very well of the story of former astronaut Lisa Nowak, who was arrested for allegedly kidnapping her lover's girlfriend. But yes, continue.
Well, there were all these questions at that point. NASA was questioned, well, what happens if someone goes loopy in space? And they said, oh, well, you know, it's not really a problem because we can tranquilize them when we tie them down. There aren't any weapons up there anyway. Well, they're lying. In every Soyuz capsule, there's one up there right now orbiting above our heads. There's this double-barreled sawed-off shotgun under the seat. And, you know, when they were telling me about this, Dawn and Ken are telling me about this weapon up there, I was sort of saying, you know, what are you talking about? Like, in space, aren't we supposed to have, like, phasers set to stun? And, you know, again, it sort of talks about the Russian system. You know, once a Soyuz landed off course in mountains in winter and the cosmonauts fell outside and lit a fire to keep warm and they were set upon by this pack of wolves and had no response, you know, what could they do? And ever since then, every Soyuz had this little something packed under the seat. And I think for me, it says so much about the Russian system, but it also says so much about how space is like, it's this extraordinary place in so many ways, and yet these very ordinary things are up there, and these very, you know, the ordeals that we have on Earth affect these guys as much as they affect us.
Right. Well, what do you think the story of the three astronauts trapped on board, you know, the International Space Station, what do you think you take from that story? I mean, what do we learn from that story?
I think from a scientific aspect, what we take from it is that, you know, in some ways, the space station is a stepping stone. It's our way to get to the moon. It's our way to get to Mars. It's how we learn how to live in space for a long time. The Russians are very good at it. Americans haven't had that much practice. And what this mission did, in a lot of ways, is replicate a Martian mission. It was as long, you know, the 6 months they were up there was as long as the journey to Mars. And then whatever crew goes to Mars will have to land and get out and fend for themselves. And Expedition 6's Soyuz malfunctioned and landed off course and was in the middle of Kazakhstan, and nobody knew where they were. And in fact, their wives and NASA officials thought they were gone, that they'd lost another crew. But these guys were, you know, in the grass in Kazakhstan, running around firing a shotgun, you know, trying to attract attention. And Dawn is sitting there trying to make a tent out of their parachute. And they proved that, you know, these missions are possible. I think these guys were able to make this very hostile environment, they were able to make this little tin can floating in this abyss seem a lot like home. And for me, that's fascinating, the adaptability of people, that we can fix ourselves to any situation and make it right somehow. For me, it was an inspiring kind of story.
Chris Jones' book is Too Far From Home, A Story of Life and Death in Space, the story of the three astronauts, actually two astronauts and a cosmonaut, trapped on board the International Space Station in 2003 and their final journey home in the Soyuz. Chris, thanks so much for telling us about it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And by the way, Sunita Williams and the other current residents of the International Space Station got some company yesterday. They were joined by two cosmonauts and American space tourist Charles Simony, who paid $25 million for the privilege and who came bearing a basket of gourmet food put together by his good friend, Martha Stewart. Well, still to come today, the sculpture of Louise Bourgeois. That's after the news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we have news from and about Iraq. This morning, President Bush said he's inviting Democrats to the White House next week to talk about their standoff over a war funding bill. But the president, speaking at the American Legion Post number 177 in Fairfax, Virginia, made it clear the meeting will not be a negotiating session.
I know we have our differences over the best course in Iraq. These differences should not prevent us from getting our troops the funding they need without withdrawal and without giving our commanders flexibility.
In Iraq today, more than 20 people died in bombings, and fierce fighting in Baghdad claimed at least six lives. Meanwhile, more Americans could be going to Iraq, some for the second time. Four National Guard units are being prepared for deployment. According to the Pentagon, the units will serve as replacement forces in the regular troop rotation and are not connected to the recent surge in Baghdad. Well, we have now an update on a story we've covered here before about the way soldiers killed in Iraq come home. A California father whose son died in Iraq has helped push through a new policy to bring the bodies of those soldiers home on private charter jets instead of commercial flights. The policy change came after John Holly complained to his congressman, Californian Republican Duncan Hunter. When John heard that his son Matthew would be coming home to San Diego on a commercial cargo hold. Army Specialist Matthew Holly was 21 when he was killed by a roadside bomb in Iraq in 2005. And John Holly joins us now with more about this story. John, welcome. And can you take us back to that time when you found out your son was coming home on a commercial flight? As many Americans are recently finding out that this happens. You say an airline executive told you this was the most expeditious way to get him home.
Actually, that was misquoted. Ah. But it was a quote in one of the news articles that rebutted what I originally started saying was wrong with what was going on.
Yeah. What was your response to thinking that your son would come home that way?
Well, you know, we had originally been told this was all happening during Thanksgiving, and we arrived in San Diego to make arrangements for my son's funeral, and he was supposed to be arriving the following week after Thanksgiving. And we were there on a Monday making the arrangements, and they popped in and told me that your son's actually going to be coming home tonight at around 8:30. And that was a total shock to us, of course, because we're in the middle of just trying to make the initial arrangements and everything. So they asked me if I wanted to meet him at the airport, and I said, of course we do. And so I said, how does that procedure work? And, of course, I had in my mind already, being former military and mm-hmm. long succession of military in our family, of how it should happen. And so he proceeded to explain, well, he's going to be in the cargo hold of the commercial airline, which was my first bell that mm-hmm. went off in my head. And I said, okay. And he said, then what will happen is the plane will arrive, and then they'll offload the passengers, and they'll offload all the baggage, and then they'll offload your son. And the baggage handlers will put him on one of those luggage dollies or something like that, and then they'll wheel him over to the freight area, and then you can go over there and pick him up.
And you're thinking what?
I'm thinking, first words I said, excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's not how my son's going to be picked up. That's not how he's coming home.
Right.
And so I went out of the office, and I talked to my casualty assistance officer on the phone, and I explained to him what they had just explained to me, and I let him know in no uncertain terms that that was acceptable to me. And so he got to work, and I went back in the office, and an hour or two later, we got word that they were expediting an honor guard from Fort Campbell of his fellow soldiers, and they were going to be arriving to meet him when he arrived in San Diego. But the only problem was with all that was the airline would not cooperate with letting them out on the tarmac. And I subsequently, in a conversation later, I asked my casual assistance officer what happened, you know, with that conversation. He basically said the airline said, in a nutshell, sorry, you know, but we got a business to run.
Yeah.
And so going back to the original day now, they were worked throughout the day trying to find a way to make it happen. And we were at home at this time, and it was about 6 p.m. in the evening. And we got a call from an assistant of Barbara Boxer's office. And he asked me, you know, what I was wanting, and I explained everything to him. And he said, well, I'll make some calls and see what I can do. And I said, well, the first call you need to make is to the FAA because they control the airlines and all the operations at the airport, and they can make them do whatever they want. And so he said, hey, that's a good idea. So about a half hour later after we hung up from him, I get a call back saying everything's all arranged, that you will be meeting your son. Excuse me, but
I know.
Well, I'm sorry. That's the hardest part of the story to tell.
Yeah.
But
let me help. Yeah. You met your son at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, at the airport. At San Diego. Big help I am. At San Diego at the airport late in 2005. And I want to say, because of your work after that, Washington has now changed policy. There's now a private charter company, Kalita Charters, an airline based in Michigan. And families can opt to have their loved ones that are fallen brought home on these charter flights, met by honor guards without all the work that you had to do. This is an amazing thing you've done. We've talked about this story here. We had a listener who actually was on a commercial flight when there was a soldier in the baggage compartment. And the flip side of this, though, John, is that he said at the time that everyone on the airline wanted to participate. They wanted to be able to honor the son of someone, much like your son. You've pushed this through so that there's more dignity to the procedure, but, I guess, what do you say to people? Well, actually, let's listen to him. Let him tell you what he wanted you to know.
Right.
If that family did know how much we cared and how much I saw all these people cry and I saw the firefighters out there in that cold respect that person, they'd understand how much we cared and how much this is happening every single day around our country. And they need to have some sort of warmth in their heart knowing that they're not alone.
It's a complicated issue, John, but we just wanted to let you know that people wanted you to know that you're not alone. And now because of your work, these fallen soldiers will not be alone when they come home.
Well, that was the whole point of the exercise was, my wife and I, as I stated many times in many media things we've done, is we didn't do this for us. We got Matthew his just dignity and honor when he came home. But we could have kept our mouths shut after that.
But now you've changed it for everybody.
Well, that's right, because it bothered me to the point where, being a veteran myself and thinking about how it affected me and how they shouldn't even have to think about these sorts of things when they're in the middle of this process.
John Holly,
be automatic.
John Holly, in the seconds we have, I just want to express also our condolences for the loss of your son Matthew, killed
Thank
in Iraq
you.
In November Thank 2005.
You, Robin.
And thanks for your work on this other issue as well.
Thank you.
John Holly, speaking to us from San Diego. You're listening to Here and Now. Live Earth is coming, the environmental version of Live Aid. It's billed as the concert for a climate in crisis, and co-founders Al Gore and Kevin Wall have picked the U.S. location for this summer's worldwide music event, New Jersey's Giants Stadium. Wall says he and Gore wanted to have the U.S. show on the Washington Mall, but the Park Service said no.
A number of major cities came to us and asked us to do it in their cities, and there became almost a bidding war, so to speak. And in the end, you know, we wanted to do it close to the greatest city in the world. So we picked New Jersey, Giants Stadium, and we're in New York City.
The 24-hour event on July 7th is a series of rolling concerts worldwide, starting in Sydney, Australia, followed by shows in Tokyo, Shanghai, Johannesburg, London, Rio, and ending in New Jersey. Giants Stadium headliners include The Police, Bon Jovi, Kanye West, The Dave Matthews Band, and The Smashing Pumpkins. But, sigh, today Roger Waters dismissed rumors that there would be a Pink Floyd reunion at Live Earth. Well, some of us would be thrilled to even be asked, but we've buried our dreams of musical careers deep in file cabinets and cubicles. What if you could turn your workplace into a place to nurture your dream? Producer Curtis Gilbert brings us a story of one Minneapolis man who did just that.
So imagine yourself at work. You're at the office late one night. Everyone else has gone home for the evening. And then from somewhere down the hall, you hear this.
I don't want to be chained. I don't want to be chained.
It's a guy. And he's not just singing, he's wailing.
No to her love.
And then you remember. Oh, yeah. It's just the guy who cleans the building.
My name is Jason Shannon, and I tell people when I first meet them that I write songs.
A year and a half ago, Jason wanted to start recording his songs. So he bought some equipment and was planning to set up a studio in his apartment, but that didn't work out.
So there's air holes and leaks in the room, there's a fridge that buzzes, there's a faucet that drips, there's people upstairs.
The neighbors not only made noise, they also weren't crazy about the idea of Jason rocking out for hours at a time. And then Jason realized there was another place, somewhere he could play late into the night without bothering anyone.
The space at work was real quiet, and one day I just mustered the guts to go into the owner's office.
And he said, "Can I talk to you?" And usually when somebody says that, you think, oh my God, they're going to quit. But Jason said,
you know, with my lips trembling, "Do you mind if I build a recording studio here?"
And I thought, oh, that sounds good, sure.
Miranda Moss loved the idea that the guy who cleaned the carpets and painted the walls at her Minneapolis marketing firm was really an aspiring rock star.
I'm excited. I think one day he's going to be very famous and we can say, oh, he worked here.
So after everyone else went home for the night, Jason would whip out his guitars, his amps, his keyboards, and he rocked the offices of Yamamoto Moss McKenzie.
Sometimes I'd record till the next morning and sleep in my space.
Three blind men jumped off a cliff and they sailed straight through the air.
Jason's friends would come by and lay down saxophone tracks, trumpet parts. I even pitched in once on background vocals.
Time goes by. Time.
Jason just moved into an artist's loft and brought his studio with him, but he still loves his job. The people are cool, and they support his music. I know a lot of artists, and most of them have some kind of other job that helps them pay the bills. But Jason's the only guy I know who took that day job and turned it into a dream job. For now. Of course, he'd still love to be able to make a living just playing music. But right now, he's happy.
I don't want to be a maintenance person. It's not part of my image. But I can tolerate doing it because doing that work is letting me do what I love to do.
Oh, my dearest son, I have a story that is one that you have heard, but I will tell it once again.
Producer Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. His story comes to us courtesy of the folks at Minnesota Public Radio's In the Loop. Stay with us. Just ahead, Giant Spiders, Headless Lovers, the sculpture of Louise Bourgeois, here and now.
Shadows in the light, there are no shadows in the light.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
C'est le murmure de l'eau qui boue. C'est le murmure de l'eau qui chante.
That's artist Louise Bourgeois, born in 1911, singing songs from her youth in Paris during an interview at the Venice Biennale in 1993. Bourgeois is still working and still exploring her complicated childhood. She married and moved to New York City in 1938, where she befriended the abstract, expressionist, minimalist, and surrealist artists who fled Europe after the war. Her drawings, paintings, and later sculpture put both the lure and the torture of relationships on display. It's now in Boston at the Institute of Contemporary Art, the second show in the acclaimed new building by Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro. I took a tour, and you can follow along on a slideshow of images at our website, here-now.org. Starting at the centerpiece of the show, a huge bronze spider, three times a human height. I asked director Jill Medvedel, what does it mean?
The spider is one of the key symbols for Louise's art, and it represents in many ways her mother for her. Louise grew up the daughter of tapestry restorers outside of Paris. And in fact, when Louise was a small child, she had the job of drawing in the legs that were frequently missing from tapestries when they came in for repair. The spider she sees as industrious, as patient, as something enveloping, something nurturing. So it stands for many of the things she cares for.
Really? Because for me, this spider's feeling pretty consuming, and I'm thinking spider that lures fly into web as I'm being lured into this room by this big spider.
Well, what I hope you'll see throughout this exhibition is this profound sense of polarity, independence and dependence, protection and violation or consumption. When you go under the spider, and maybe we should do that together.
Okay, we are walking under the spider.
It doesn't feel as dangerous when you're inside it as it does when you're outside of it.
Actually, now I feel like in the Nutcracker, there's the character that comes out with a big skirt and all the kids get under the skirt.
That's exactly right. And so that's a protective image of come in, come in, come in. Let me take care of you. Let me protect you.
Dans ce grand Paris, si loin de mon pays, de l'endroit où j'ai vécu.
Tell me more about the family, a household that was repressive on the one hand, but incredibly promiscuous on the other. Her father even bedding her tutor, we understand, at home in the house, Louise's tutor, that is. So tell me more about how her parents shaped her work.
Her father was apparently a very charming, charming, seductive man. And in fact, he did seduce and bed Sadie, who was Louise's nanny, and, you know, I think quite egregious for young Louise, brought Sadie to live in the home. And this sense of triangulation, mother, father, Sadie, mother, father, Louise, is something you're going to see over and over again to keep reworking. What I see is just a fundamental set of oppositions of pleasure and suffering, of a longing for wholeness with a great sense of fragmentation. This piece is called Arched Figure, and one of the differences you see is she's using soft material instead of needing to work with foundries and casts.
It looks like someone in an arch, almost a backbend, but there's no head, no real legs. And yet over here we have another figure, and this is a fully formed figure. There's a head, there's arms, there's an outline we're familiar with, but there is a steel crutch and an old fashioned wooden peg leg.
So many of the figures are missing their heads. This one is missing its leg. Some of those images, I think, are long, deeply held images from the war, where there were so many soldiers coming back with body parts missing. You know,
and by the way, you're talking about World War I.
Yes. This notion of the part as opposed to the whole, the sense of abandonment that she felt when her father, in essence, abandoned the original unit of the family, as well as, I would say, when her mother died, when Louise was fairly young, that this longing for wholeness and yet being consumed by this sense of fragmentation, of abandonment. All the work is very much depicting that in all these different ways.
Et voilà, je suis diplômé. Le beau roman est terminé.
You know, it's interesting. She's called a feminist artist. Her work so clearly references, as you say, whatever it is she could not have in that family of origin. But she was a mother of three, happily married. And I've tried to find references to, you know, being a working mother, being a mother in her work. I don't feel I see that as much.
That's interesting. I don't know that Louise would actually agree with me here as well, but I believe that that series, Femme Maison, Woman House, in which the torso and the head of the figure is replaced with a New York City either skyscraper or apartment building, is very much about the sense of confinement and entrapment that many of us working mothers feel when we are in the house, but ambitious, have ambitions that also go beyond our home. The claiming of sex and sexuality as a topic, those are all areas that really feminist artists carved out. You know, up till the 60s, with very few exceptions, women were mostly the subjects in works of art. They weren't defining the territory.
Well, and especially in sculpture, which had such a masculine connotation, you hammer things and you use blow torches or whatever, and it was not a woman's purview.
Still isn't, I would say. Absolutely. So I do think that I met Louise because when I was in graduate school, almost 30 years ago to the day, but there was a little notice tacked up where I went to graduate school in New York City that somebody was looking for help to move boxes. And I needed to work, and so I called and I made an appointment to go see somebody named Louise Bourgeois, who, in my incredible naivete, and also because she did not have a reputation because of the nature of the world.
She would go on to be the first woman to have a show at MoMA, was it?
Yes, in 1982, she had the first retrospective for a woman. But at any rate, I knocked on a door in Chelsea, knock, 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 and this fabulous woman who was short like me and just coquettish and lively and, fantastic, opened the door and looked me up and down and asked if I was strong enough to move the books, and I was, and so that was the beginning of what evolved into a series of both jobs and ultimately a long relationship.
What'd she talk about? What interested her?
She loved artists. She always, to this day, opens her home to artists, but she is somebody who has this uncanny ability to get a bead on you and, without even knowing you well, might go straight to your most vulnerable point. You know, another interesting way to kind of get an understanding of Louise's, after her husband died, she pulled out her stove and henceforth lived only with burners, but decided that that aspect of the family home would be no longer.
What did that mean to her? What did that represent?
I think it meant, you know, I don't want to put words in her mouth for something as kind of profound an act as that, but I think it really meant that a domesticity of a certain sort was over, and I think it also shows you some of the violence that is contained within this charming small woman, in which she is struggling with feelings that really have a lot to do with, you know, decades-old sense of both rage against the feelings of independence and dependence, powerlessness and strength.
Jill Medvedow, again, director of the Institute of Contemporary Art here in Boston. And you can see some of the images from Bourgeois in Boston at our website, here-now.org. And for our listeners in the Philly area, there's another Bourgeois spider at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. We leave you with more of Louise Bourgeois singing in a remix from DJ Frederick Sanchez. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.